on Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA. It's The Buzz with Dr. Z, supported by the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. Dr. Z is Dr. George Zlopko. He's the director and founder of the foundation. And I'm Doug Herendeen on WRTA. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Doug, it's great to be here again, as always, the third Tuesday of each month, huh?
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe it's already September.
I don't know where the year's gone.
Some of the sunshine is still there, so I'm happy about that.
And we've only got a couple of days until it is officially fall.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the things I'd like to talk about today, Doug, and we'll get right into it, is one of the scarring diseases of the lung. And to start off with, it might be worthwhile to talk about what a scar really is. And I hope you've never had to have a scar on your skin or something, get a cut or or some type of trauma. But those of you who have will notice that where the cut is, as it heals, it doesn't heal smoothly. It's not, you can recognize where that break in the skin had been. And that little line that you see, and sometimes it's a big line, is a scar. What that is, it's a deposition of some material called collagen. That's really not important for most folks to know, but it's a protein we have in our body, and it fills in a spot where there's been some type of insult, some type of injury, some type of inflammation.
Well, this is what you always hear about in the TV commercials where they're saying collagen is good for your face or some such thing.
Well, it is good. It's not that it's a bad thing. It's actually necessary for the healing process. Unfortunately, if the injury or the inflammation or whatever starts the deposition of collagen to occur is severe enough, once that those collagen fibers, if you will, and they're kind of fibers of protein, once they're laid down, they don't go away. And so the problem comes in for patients with some of these diseases. Once the disease progresses to a certain extent, they begin to have symptoms. There may not be a lot to take those. As a matter of fact, there isn't anything that we know of now that will take those scars away. So knowing that you have a disease, a scar disease of the lung, particularly certain types, and we'll talk a little bit about which there's several types, then you may want to try and do something about it. We do have some things we can do about it, but you certainly want a diagnosis made and the appropriate referrals for other more advanced therapies if necessary. The patients may ask, well, what triggered this for me? Why am I having this scarring in the lung?
Yeah, I was going to say, because if you get a cut or you have an incision for a surgery, you can understand why that would be damage to the skin. And I never knew that it was collagen that came in to take care of that. But I can only imagine what a problem this would be in something like inside someone's lung.
That's right. And what triggers it, at least as far as we know, and we don't know everything about this, to be honest with you, is that there is some mechanism that creates inflammation within the lung tissue. Something triggers that. And you say, what could it be? Well, it could be some other disease. It could be something that you've inhaled. It could be some medication that you may have taken. And it triggers this cascade of inflammation and healing. So there's inflammation, irritation. This is in the tissue of the lung now. It's not in the airways.
This is inside.
Inside. But it's in the tissue of the lungs, not in the airways. And this inflammation continues to smolder, kind of like a fire, you know, that you might have. And as there's irritation and then healing and irritation and then healing, these collagen fibers are laid down, this scar tissue is laid down, and they eventually obstruct the normal function of the lung tissue. And the patient gets symptoms.
How bad does it have to be before it is noticeable to somebody?
Well, it depends. You know, everybody has their own level of comfort. Most of the time, patients are sent to us with these types of diseases who may not have many symptoms, but had an X-ray, for example, that has shown the scars on the X-ray film.
You can actually see it that well.
Yes, you can. And you can see the large amounts of it. You can see small amounts of it. In addition, you can hear it. There is a particular little crackling sound of the lung that it makes when we listen to it with a stethoscope that tells us that there's some scarring in the lung.
Oh, so when I'm going to the doctor and he says, breathe, that's what he's listening for, among other things.
Well, that's one of the things that he is listening for. Usually it starts at the bases of the lung, so at the bottom part of the lung, and you ask the patient to take a deep breath. If you want to make the sound that it makes, and it's hard, I think, on the radio for me to show you, but if you take some hair between your fingers that's right by your ear, mm-hmm. and you kind of twist it,
yeah.
you know, particularly if you have longer hair.
Play along at home.
You know, particularly if you have longer hair that kind of comes, you know, over your ear so you can hear it, and you twist it, you'll hear a little like crackling sound. And yeah. that simulates, to a certain degree, some people have more than others, the kind of crackling sound I'm talking about.
And that's something that the doctor can hear. You're not hearing that, but you're being affected by.
Right. The patient doesn't hear that at all. The patient does hear that at all.
This is what the doctor hears in the stethoscope.
That's right. The most common symptom that patients have with these scarring diseases of the lung, usually the first symptom may be just cough, you know, and of course cough has a cause in many, many, many disease processes and some that aren't even diseases, but cough would be one. And then as the disease progresses, shortness of breath becomes very prominent. And unfortunately, the patient's most severely affected, and toward the end of life with this disease, they're very short of breath.
Mm.
The treatment plan, which we'll talk about in one of the other segments here today, helps to reduce the progression of this disease. So the first thing is patients who have this kind of problem need to be diagnosed properly. And we'll talk about how that's done in the next segment. So scarring diseases of the lung involve the laying down of collagen fiber in the lung tissue in response to some type of irritation. By the way, it could be irritation from something you inhaled. These fellows will talk, I'm going to mention this at the end, that were at 9/11 who were inhaling all this
right.
material, et cetera. You've also heard about service people who were exposed to burn pits
right.
whatnot.
Right.
Well, some of them will.
Or black lung.
Or black lung can do that. It could cause scarring. Those are the types of things I'm talking about that can begin this inflammatory process in the lung tissue that continues to revolve and move and go on, doesn't stop. And once triggered, it lays down these collagen fibers and causes the scarring to be seriously present in the lungs.
You know, I never thought necessarily about it the same way. I figured that something like black lung, the lungs are completely impaired by the amount that you've inhaled of coal dust, something my uncle would have gone through when he was a coal miner. But the amount of function, and like you said, everybody's different on this, but I'm just thinking, I always thought it was that there was too much stuff filling the lungs to let them be exposed to the air. But even if this is exposed to the air, if it's got the scarring on it, it's not going to help.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't work well. It doesn't work well. It's the scarring process. For example, you're talking about coal miners. That's one disease process that may result in some scarring. Mostly, though, the patients who have been exposed not just to coal dust but rock dust as well, and many of the miners. Were exposed not just to coal dust but rock dust because they were mining and some places didn't have coal. There was rock. They had to dig that out. And it's the silica that's in that rock dust that creates a scarring process in the lungs as well, one that continues to progress over time and can be the cause for serious disability for many of these patients.
The Buzz with Dr. Z on WRTA. Is sponsored by and supported by the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. Dr. Z is Dr. George Lupko, and we're talking about pulmonary fibrosis, scarring of the lungs. And one of the things you were talking about with coal dust and people who also would deal with the stone quarries, getting the silica in their lungs, I'm thinking about, well, anybody that, for instance, if you work out, you notice that people put powder all over their hands and they always get this cloud of smoke around them, and I'm thinking, is that good to inhale? I'm guessing not. And what about people who work in sawmills?
Well, in terms of the powder that we're talking about, this is talc. This is a type of silica dust. It's a silicate, and it can, in significant quantities, cause scarring of the lung. Likewise, there are a number of other inhaled irritants that can do this. The business about the sawmills is a little bit different. The particles from sawing and whatnot are really too big to enter the lung. Sometimes it says a very fine dust, but really, from a medical point of view, they're large particles. They usually get trapped in the nose, the mouth, and the upper airway. But there can be infectious agents, certain types of fungus, and other types of what we call antigens that may be present in the sawdust, which can create an irritating process in the lung and result in fibrosis. As I indicated, the diagnosis is absolutely imperative because for some people, this is a serious, life-threatening, and unfortunately fatal disease. Not everyone, but many patients it is. You have to understand that the cause for this scarring is long. There's a whole arm's length of potential causes. The first thing we look for when someone comes in, let's say with a CT scan, a CAT scan of the chest that shows some scarring in the lung, is take a history. What have you been exposed to? What do you do? What did you do in your life? And the other thing we want to try and do is find out whether or not they have one of the other diseases or one of the diseases that we know can cause this trouble. For example, patients who have so-called collagen vascular diseases like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, particularly one called scleroderma. Okay, these are diseases which can result in scarring of the lung, and there are tests to see whether or not you have these particular diseases.
Now, I wouldn't have thought those diseases would affect your lung as much as they would affect muscle function or other portions of the body. But it affects the lungs as well.
Well, yes, these are what we call systemic diseases. So they basically can affect any part of the body, and one of the parts is the lung. And particularly with scleroderma, but also with rheumatoid arthritis, we see that fairly often. And so if you have one of those diseases, we know that that's where we have to direct our therapy to try and control that disease process. There is another whole category of scarring of the lung, which we call idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. And when physicians use the term idiopathic, what it means is we don't know what causes it. That's basically the fancy term that says we don't know.
But you know it's there.
But we know it's there. And the fact that we don't know what causes it is part of the problem in terms of treatment, because unlike, say, rheumatoid arthritis or scleroderma, where we can direct a treatment to that disease process, when it's so-called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis or idiopathic scarring of the lung, we don't know what causes it. Before we assign that diagnosis to somebody, we usually try and find out whether they could have any of these other situations. Because idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, although like many diseases can run from mild to wild, can be extremely severe and have a rather poor prognosis for the patients who have it. The scarring advances over a short period of time. They get more and more symptoms. They get more and more short of breath. They require oxygen therapy. And in the end, it's very difficult to save their life.
How many people, or what percentage, I guess, would be of the population have to deal with any type of scarring of the lungs?
Well, if we're talking about generalized scarring of the lung, like caused by everything and anything, there's probably a lot. You don't realize, particularly city dwellers or people who work in industries where they're exposed to a variety of industrial dusts and things like that, all develop some scarring in the lung. The question will become whether or not it's enough to, for example, hear or see on an x-ray or cause them some symptoms. That's really where it's at. But we, in the modern era here, unless you're, I guess, living out in the middle of nowhere and you're not exposed to anything.
The Amish, maybe.
Maybe. Although they are exposed to a lot of organic dusts.
That's true.
They're farmers, and so they're in the barn and whatnot. These exposures can create scarring in the lung. If you live in any kind of urban area, you're going to get some of this process occurring. The difference between those types of problems and idiopathic scarring is that they generally are not very, they're generally not very progressive unless you have significant exposure over a long period of time. You know, you talked about silica dust, you talked about talc. If you smell some talcum powder once or twice in your life, you're not going to get one of these diseases.
Yeah.
But if you're constantly exposed, for example, one of the interesting occupations that can result in scarring of the lung are those people who are involved in the making of dentures, because there's a certain amount of grinding that goes on, and the dust that results from the grinding when they're making the dentures, they breathe, and it can create scarring in the lung.
Good night. I've never seen anybody make dentures, but I would figure they have to handcraft them somehow.
Yeah, and there's some drilling that goes on and whatnot, and so that can create the problem. The other thing that industry where we see more and more of, you know, a lot of people have their kitchens redone, and they have these countertops that are made out of really not stone, but materials that are made to look like stone.
Right.
Well, there's sawing and grinding and whatnot that goes on with that, and the inhalation of those dusts can create problems with scarring in the lung.
So the people who install them or fit them are going to be around that more than the homeowner is, though.
Oh, yes. No, once they're installed, that's not a problem, but I'm talking about the people who manipulate them. They're sawing them, they're constructing them, they're making them, anything that creates dust from them.
Is there some way that can be filtered out, or are these particles too fine for most types of masks or anything that would be reasonable to wear? I mean, without putting an entire suit over your head or something.
No, not at all. Most of these particles could be filtered out. Of course, the problem comes in industry where it's difficult to put on some of these protective gears and do the job. Many of the people who work in, say, mining, find that they can't wear them because they're too hot. They feel claustrophobic in them, etc. The folks who do these countertops, they should wear a mask. They should wear actually a covering that would prevent them from getting these dusts. Generally speaking, these are small mom and pop operations, or fairly small businesses, and so they're not really compelled by OSHA or any of these government agencies to do that, and so they don't. And again, unfortunately, once the process has either started or created its damage, there's not much you can do about that. You can't remove the scarring out of the lung.
Just like you can't remove a scar that if you, say, had a dog bite or a scratch or something that had to get stitches,
right,
you're going to have that scar.
That's right.
And that's in your lung when
that's
you have
right.
this.
Yeah. So, again, the initial diagnosis, their diagnostic process starts with a history of, are you exposed to any of these things? If you are, you know, it's like the old saw, if it hurts when you bend over, don't bend over. Well, don't be exposed to these anymore. That's not always easy. And then,
especially if it's your life's work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's some practicalities here. And then, of course, you have people who have these other disease processes. Like I said, collagen vascular disease is being a big one, rheumatoid arthritis, scleroderma, things like that. But there are also some medications that can do this.
On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, The Buzz with Dr. Z, Dr. George Slupko, supported by the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. We're talking about scarring in lungs, pulmonary fibrosis, and one of the things that could cause this, we were talking about rheumatoid arthritis and other things which you may not think would be a cause or any concern about this. Another thing is medications?
Yes, there are some medications which can do it. One of the more common ones that actually patients are referred to us for to see whether or not they've had the consequences of this medication is something called amiodarone, which not everybody is familiar with, of course, but patients with certain cardiac diseases, it's a cardiac medication, heart disease medication,
okay,
that patients will take to help stabilize their heart, to reduce dysrhythmias, things like that. And for some patients who take it for an extended period of time or in high doses, it will cause scarring in the lung and prevent them from from their lungs from functioning properly.
Now, what is it about the way the medication affects their body that would cause scarring?
I wish I could tell you that. I think the drug company who makes it would give me a lot of money if I could tell them how it is. But we don't know. But we know that there's this association. And cardiologists are familiar with it. It's not that we're not familiar with it. The problem is it's a medication that for many patients is a very vital medication. And so
life-saving.
And if they can't have it or if it's creating this problem, they may be seriously compromised. So like many things that we do in medicine, there's always a yin and yang. There's a good part and there's a bad part. There's nothing we can do to you that doesn't have a potential side effect. And in this particular case, this one medication, it's not the only one, but it's the one common one that I would imagine some of the listeners out there would know about or maybe even be on that can do this. So we know that there are these things. How do we further make the diagnosis in patients with pulmonary fibrosis? We've already talked about taking a history. We've already talked about examinations. Breathing tests can help us. They can help confirm the fact that the lungs are not functioning properly and that this scarring is creating some difficulty. Unlike the breathing test for patients who have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is what we refer to as an obstructive ventilatory impairment, which means the airflow is obstructed going in and out through the air tubes, this particular disease process is much more restrictive. And what we mean by that is that the lungs actually become stiffer because of this scarring, and they cannot expand. I'll just, in simple terms, they can't expand adequately with a breath. This lack of expansion also underlies the fact that these scars affect the lung tissue to the extent where the capillaries, the little small, tiny blood vessels that are associated with your air sacs, the alveoli, where you exchange air, are disrupted. And that creates a real problem because these patients then have difficulty oxygenating their blood because of this scarring effect in the lung. It had been common practice in the past to actually biopsy the lung to look at the lung tissue to see whether or not it not only contained these fibrotic elements, but also was there anything about the picture in the lung with these biopsies that help with the diagnosis. In other words, did we think that this was more related to collagen vascular disease, for example, or was it more of this idiopathic variety? We're not doing that very much anymore. It didn't seem to really pan out. There's enough knowledge about the diagnosis that we can usually make a very accurate diagnosis about what kind of scarring you have based on the things we've already talked about. But X-ray data, pulmonary function data, of course, measuring your oxygen level. We have a little device at the Lung Disease Center that can actually measure not only your oxygen level in your bloodstream by percentage, which is what you do with something called a pulse oximeter, that little thing you put on your finger. To measure.
Yeah.
But we actually have an algorithm that can measure that in your bloodstream. And instead of having to stick a needle in your artery and take a sample, we can actually measure it that way. We can also actually measure the amount of carbon dioxide in your blood with this little device. So it's very simple. You just breathe into this little tube for a couple of minutes, and it gives us that data. So these are things that we would follow for these patients. We would talk about their medications, what modifications we can make, et cetera.
And how do you even begin to treat something like this? Or are there multiple types of treatments?
Well, as I said, if we know that there is a specific disease process that is causing this, the basic treatment would be to treat that disease and try and suppress it.
Okay.
If that's not possible or if you don't have one of the diseases, then there are two medications which are currently on the market which have been shown to reduce the progression of the scarring in the lung. And we recommend those to the patients. They have some side effects as well, mostly GI side effects. That is, they create some stomach discomfort or diarrhea or cramping or whatnot. But they can be effective but only a percentage of patients. Most of the patients who take these, we usually quote about a 30% response rate in terms of suppressing the progression of disease. You say, well, is that really worth it? Well, it is if you have one of these idiopathic, rapidly progressive varieties because the median survival is about 3 years from the time of onset of disease to the time of death, which is not very promising. And it's not a comfortable time because the patients are short of breath. They're on oxygen therapy. So that's the medication treatment. The other treatment that we recommend, or at least refer patients to, is to the transplant center, because patients with this disease may have no other option but to have their lungs transplanted. Once again, that's not something you'd think about as the first-line therapy. But once we have patients with these diseases, knowing that they have a progressive, what we call progressive phenotype, progressive quality to them, usually we'll send them to the transplant center for at least a consultation and get them on the list of patients who may need a transplant in the future. Hmm. And so we're prepared for that down the road.
How have lung transplants progressed over the years? I think we remember former Governor Casey had a lung and heart transplant, and that was considered, I consider it a marvel of medicine that he was able to live as long as he did afterwards. But when somebody has a lung transplant, first off, can they do only one, or is it always two? And what are the odds that that works for you?
Well, the odds that they work for you, that's a different story. That depends on a lot of factors, basically the condition that you're in at the time of the transplant. You can transplant one lung, and you can transplant two lungs. It really depends on what's available to you at the time of transplantation. In other words, if there is an accident and a patient comes in with a damaged right lung, but the left lung is okay, then the transplant recipient may be offered the single lung transplant. The problem with with the lung transplants, and there are many, but they're very helpful to many patients. I mean, there many patients have survived a good bit of time with them, is that when you take the lungs out of someone and put them in someone else, you've cut the nerves that normally supply the lung. And so these patients don't have a good cough reflex. Their immunity is suppressed to a certain degree. And so the immediate problem for them is not just rejection of the transplant, which is, of course, a substantial thing to consider, but also infection and the inability to clear secretions. And many of these patients spend a good bit of time following the transplant just staying at the hospital because they have to have bronchoscopies to help suck out the mucus and things like that. They're on medications to suppress the immune process so that they don't reject the lungs. So it's not an easy transplant to have. When you compare it to, say, kidney transplants or even liver transplants, it's a much more difficult post-operative and recuperative period. And we know that the average, well, there's about a 50% three-year survival with lung transplantation. So if you don't need a lung transplant, I would advise you not to get one.
Final thoughts just to wrap up here on pulmonary fibrosis.
I think that if you have a cough, for example, that's been present, if you're on any of these medications, a medication like we talked about, if you have any of these other disease processes that I mentioned, you may want to have your family physician get a CAT scan of your chest to look to see if we can see the scarring. You may want to be examined by a pulmonary physician to see if we can hear the scarring and do some pulmonary function studies to see if there's any deficit in your breathing ability because of it.
And a reminder, if you have any questions or comments on anything that Dr. Z has mentioned, Doug@LeitnerRadio.com. That's Doug@LeitnerRadio.com, or anything else you'd like him to address in future shows. On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, it's The Buzz with Dr. Z, supported by the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. I'm Doug Herendeen. Dr. Z, Dr. George Lupko. And you had a thought related to what we discussed with scarring of lungs and pulmonary fibrosis and the final thought segment here.
Well, I usually save this segment for something very topical or a deep thought, but I have to tell you that we just went through the anniversary of 9/11. And I had the opportunity to see a program that highlighted the efforts of the New York City Fire Department during this particular unpleasant part of our American history, the collapse of the towers in New York. And as it applies to this particular program, I alluded to it earlier, along with the many, many stressors that these patients or these firefighters had at this time, was the fact that they were exposed to a huge amount of toxic dust from the collapse of these towers. Now, at the time, it was just a worrisome, bothersome problem. They'd wear a mask, try and put some gear on to filter out some of this dust. What many of these firefighters didn't know, and we didn't even know that as physicians, was what would happen to these folks later on in time. And what we're seeing now, and have been seeing, are these firefighters, the ones who survived, and by the way, not all of them survived, over 300 New York firefighters died on 9/11 in the towers. The effects of these exposures are now coming forward, and they're developing diseases, not just scarring diseases of the lung, which many of them developed, but also cancers and other particular specific problems involving other lungs and surrounding tissue, for that matter, such as their mouth and vocal cords and whatnot. And I have to say, when I saw this program, I was really moved by the bravery that these men had, and it was what really made me think about doing a program on scarring disease of the lung because of what they'd been exposed to. What I will say is they were not the only ones exposed. There were a lot of people in New York, citizens of New York, who were exposed as well. And we're seeing flare-ups in lung disease from those folks because of the same types of exposures. These are somewhat analogous to what we're seeing in our soldiers who are exposed to the burn pits in Iraq. And this is not a made-up process. This is something that's really happened, and these folks are really affected. And beyond my thoughts on just 9/11 itself and the bravery that these folks had, has to do with the medical conditions that resulted from these exposures.
And they've just had we like you said, we didn't know how this was going to play out because nobody had ever been exposed to that toxic soup of chemicals and dust going into their lungs. Not just the firefighters and the police, but also the people who are running from it. You saw tons of the video where they were enveloped in this cloud of ash and who knows what all else was in it, but it was all toxic to a certain extent. And anybody that was near this, even for days after, was exposed.
That's correct, Doug. So I'm kind of taken back by not only the medical implications of what happened there, but of course, as I said, the admiration I have for all of those first responders, and even just the people of New York who were there, who had to take on whatever responsibilities they had just to get by following the collapse of these towers.
There's been some concern about people being able to take care of them, benefits that maybe could be due or that could be arranged for the first responders who ran into danger. They didn't run away from it. They ran right into it. Those that survived have had a rough time of it, as you said. Any thoughts about compensation or any type of thing that as a country we can do for them?
Well, surprisingly, there is a compensation fund for these folks. What isn't known is the fact that you don't have to be a firefighter or a policeman to get that compensation. And this was the point of one of the messages that followed this particular show. Now, if you're asking me how you go about that and how you do it, I can't tell you. But I do know that there is compensation for those folks who can show that they were exposed at 9/11 and have a pulmonary problem, a lung problem that is recognized to have resulted from some of that exposure. Whether you're a fireman, a policeman, a first responder, you can just be a citizen.
It's just amazing what we asked them to do. Actually, nobody asked them to do this much, but it was always implied, no matter what disaster fell, that they would be going toward it, and they did. And I don't know. I hear some people say, well, you know, we've given them enough. We've done this. We've done that. We can't do any more for them. And I'm thinking, they signed up for a lot, but I don't know if they signed up for this.
Well, here's what we can do. So is there anything more we can do? We can just not forget. This is an event that happened. It was a sentinel event for the United States, seeing that we weren't indeed vulnerable to outside attack. And again, without making this a political commentary or anything, I just want to say that it showed us how vulnerable we could be as a technologically advanced society. That doesn't help. I mean, someone can blow up the train station, someone can blow up the tower, someone can blow up the electrical buildings, etc., and really affect our entire life.
Just to finish off, we were talking about scarring of the lungs, pulmonary fibrosis, and we have just about a minute here. Is there anything that you want to add, or just to recap anything we've discussed in the program?
Well, just to say that the scarring of the lung is not something to just take lightly. If you've been told that you have some scarring in your lung, or you have fibrosis, which is the fancy medical term for this scarring effect, you really should have it looked into, because if you have, unfortunately, one of what we call a progressive phenotype, or the type of picture that shows us that this scarring is progressing despite your best efforts at whatever you're doing, then you really need to have some special attention, either be offered some of these medications which may be able to control the progression of disease, maybe have a transplant consultation just so you're prepared down the road. And of course, also, if you need oxygen or other particular measures to help support yourself.
Dr. George Lupko is with the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. They're on the web. They're on the Facebook page. They will be listed in links on the podcast of this program, which will be up later on WRTA.com. Dr. Zlupko, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Doug. It's always a pleasure to be with you. I look forward to seeing you next month on the third Tuesday in October.
On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA.